Great to have you with us here on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here, and we're going to be talking about legal issues on the show today with a couple of guests. Mike Riley, one of our guests, is back with us. He represents clients in insurance coverage issues, mediation, arbitration, things of that nature, a senior partner in the Axley Law Firm in Madison. With Mike, Catherine Grigg, a divorce and family law attorney, also a partner in the Axley Law Firm. So we'll be taking your legal questions today, and I hope you'll join in the conversation. The number is 1-800-642-1234. Send us an email to ideas@wpr.org, or you can post on our Facebook page. Just a reminder, today our discussion is intended as general information and should not be relied on or construed as legal advice. So great to have Mike and Catherine with us today. Mike, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
Thanks, Larry. Pleasure to be here.
Catherine, thank you for joining us today as well. Appreciate it.
Thank you. Thanks for inviting me.
Mike, first, tell us, you know, I said a few things about what you do, but what tell us about the legal areas you cover.
Sure. My focus of my practice is really personal injury matters. So I help people who've been injured in all sorts of accidents, most commonly auto accidents. And we work with them to get their cases resolved in a way that's fair. That means working with the insurance companies, working with them. Ultimately, cases may go to trial, but it's increasingly rare, Larry. What's happened now is that most cases get resolved with the company either before you have to file a lawsuit or after you file a lawsuit, but well before there's ever a trial. Mediation, which is something else I do, has become increasingly popular. And in the last 10 to 15 years has really made trials an endangered species. In fact, lawyers talk about it a lot and talk about the fact that it's very hard to get younger lawyers trial experience in my area of the law, at least. And Katie can talk about hers, but certainly that's true in my area of the law. So, you know, that's the focus of my practice. Been doing it for a lot of years. And it's something, I guess, that segues into what you and I talked about maybe discussing a bit, and that is, kind of, first of all, deciding when you need a lawyer.
Yeah.
And then secondly, choosing what lawyer you may want to help you with your particular situation.
Yeah, and I want to talk with you more about that. But, Catherine, maybe you could talk about, well, the basically the issues involved in family law that you deal with.
Sure. Well, family law is a general term that encompasses a lot of different practice areas. Divorce is one of them, but it also includes situations where people are not married and they have children together, those type of paternity cases and the fallout of the paternity case. It also includes situations where a couple wants to negotiate a prenup before they get married or a postnup, which is an agreement that a married couple enters into during the marriage, sometimes in place of getting a separation. Family law also includes things like grandparent visitation issues, child support issues, custody and placement issues. Lots of different things fall under that umbrella.
You mentioned postnup.
Yeah.
That's an interesting one to me that I hadn't heard about or knew much about.
They're pretty common. Postnups come into play often if during the marriage one of the spouses might inherit an asset or maybe a family business or comes into some financial circumstance that the other spouse doesn't necessarily want to be involved with, like maybe accumulation of debt, maybe a gambling debt or other sorts of debts. It also can just be a situation where a couple recognizes that maybe they're headed towards the path of separation or divorce, perhaps because financial issues are one of the greatest stressors. And so a postnup is a way for that couple to try to address and come to an agreement and some written terms about how they're going to handle their finances during the marriage and what their legal rights are so that they don't have to have that continued stress during the marriage and it allows them to stay married. A postnup, though, does address and anticipates a situation where they might ultimately get divorced. So what you're sort of doing both with a postnup and a prenup is you're having the tough conversation of, if we do end up getting divorced someday, how are things going to be divided? And that's a really sensitive, difficult conversation for a couple to have.
And, you know, that would be an obvious case where you'd want an attorney. Mike, are there, you know, and there are obvious cases where you're going to automatically you're going to want an attorney. But basically, when do you need one?
Well, and that's a great question. You're right, Larry. It's variable. But I always encourage people in a lot of situations to reach out if you've got a dispute with a, you know, an individual, a company, whatever, you know, reach out and see if it can be settled. I always tell people stop before it gets really rancorous because that just makes things more unpleasant and more difficult. But I, part of this thought was triggered because I read a column the other day and it was one of the local newspapers and they do these help things where people are having a problem and they reach out and try to help them. And in this case, they did and the problem was solved. But at the end of the day, it turned out the woman had never bothered to call the company, which seemed to be quite willing to resolve the thing as soon as they were called.
So, why wouldn't you?
Well, I think people are intimidated, and I think people sometimes think, well, if I do this or do that, you can always talk to somebody about anything. You know, you can reach some kind of an agreement, you know, on your own. If you're not sure you know how to evaluate the situation, that's really one case where you need a lawyer. I had a case that was kind of funny years ago. It was my only tattooing malpractice claim that I've handled in my lengthy career. The gal came to me and had this tattoo, which to begin with, to me, was one of the ugliest things I've seen. It was effectively looked like a little bracelet with alternate blue and skin and blue and skin. But it had bled, and that was her complaint, that it had bled. So she came to me, and she was all overwrought about it. And you know, I mean, understandably in a way. But I said, have you talked to him? Well, no. I said, well, let's call him. So we picked up the phone, called the guy at the tattoo parlor, said, you know, she's here. She's concerned about this. He said, just send her back in. We can fix that. That's no problem. And I said, great. So we sent her back in. She came back
happy.
A few weeks later, said, yeah, look at this. It's great. So I do think sometimes people, you know, jump the gun a little bit and are you know, eager to get litigious. And really, people are not nearly as litigious as the media would lead us to believe. But there are cases where people could handle it by themselves. Some people just can't. You know, they're just they're terrified. They don't know what to do. I think if you have something that involves a significant amount of money, if you have something that involves an insurance company on the other side, I think those are cases where, you know, if it's a matter of repairs to your car, that's usually very simple. That's just not a problem. We see that all the time. When you start talking about an injury, you know, people will call me and say, Joe was just injured, and, you know, what should I do? And I'll tell them what to do. And I'll say, call me again in a couple weeks. If it turns out that this resolves very quickly and you're doing well, feel like you're back to where you were, I can give you some quick advice and say, call them, tell them this. If you get to this range, that's probably reasonable. If it's a more serious injury, when it goes beyond that, and particularly if you have significant medical expenses or you have a serious injury, at that point, you know, you really do need to talk to a lawyer. And frankly, in any situation, if you're uncomfortable, then, you know, feel free to call a lawyer. Most lawyers are happy to talk to you. We'll give you, you know, happy to answer some questions for you without charging you money. They don't, you know, hit the meter like they used to do in the old cabs. People are willing to talk to you and give you some advice. In terms of choosing a lawyer, I'm going to make this real brief because I know we've got some questions. One, you know, the first thing is, for heaven's sakes, don't rely on advertising. There are firms that are really good firms that advertise, or firms that I have very little respect for that advertise. The bottom line is, advertising, no matter how good, is no measure of how good the lawyer is. You know, Madison Magazine does a Best Lawyers every year. Milwaukee Magazine does a statewide Super Lawyers. Martindale Hubbell is a nationally known rating organization. AV is the best you can be. BV is good. There are a bunch of different sources you can go to get a sense, to begin with, of what kind of credentials. Of course, everyone has websites now, and you can take a look at the website. But the biggest thing to me is always go and meet with a lawyer. Don't necessarily just say, okay, that's it, that's my choice. Meet with one or two people and talk to them. See who you're comfortable with, particularly with divorce, like Katie does, and personal injury like I do. These things don't go away in a week or two. It's a relationship you're going to have. They're very important decisions that are going to have a real impact on your life. ultimately, you're probably going to have to listen to your lawyer's advice about how to resolve this thing one way or another. So you want somebody you're comfortable with, you want somebody who will be open to communicating with you, and you want somebody who you're going to trust when they give you advice.
Yeah. I have a, Catherine, I have, I've gone through a divorce, and you hired an attorney and used an attorney, and we had a very good result for both my ex-wife and myself. I know someone else, a friend who they had a... who went through a divorce and didn't use an attorney. What are your thoughts on an attorney involved with a divorce?
It's interesting. I think something around 75% of the cases in Dane County and surrounding areas involving divorce do not have attorney involvement. So that really is the norm, that a lot of people try to navigate through the divorce process on their own. And many couples are successful in doing that. The situations, though, that I think in family law certainly require more help are similar to the ones that Mike just described. If you're dealing with a situation where you just aren't comfortable negotiating or talking to the other side, in this case, your spouse. If it's the type of thing where you're very stressed and worried and it's starting to really seep into your work or your relationships with other people and is causing quite an additional burden, having a divorce lawyer is a person who can take some of that stress and some of that worry off your hands.
Off your hands.
Yeah, and to deal with things so that you don't have to and you can focus on your job and your kids and other situations. I think anytime that you have really complicated assets involved, you might at least want to consider consulting with an attorney. Anytime that there might be some domestic violence involved or other sensitive issues that require some additional security or other types of considerations, those are certainly ones too where it's more appropriate to hire a lawyer. But ultimately, it's a choice by the parties. And just because one spouse hires a lawyer does not automatically mean the other person needs to lawyer up. But certainly it can create a feeling of an imbalance of power if your spouse has an attorney and you don't. And it, contrary to what a lot of people believe, one attorney cannot represent both spouses in a divorce. I get that question an awful lot where the couple is amicable and they agree on most things. They just don't want to spend the cost of hiring two lawyers, but they recognize that they do need help getting the paperwork in order and making sure that all of the T's get crossed. And so they do want to have a lawyer in the case. And what I have to tell those couples is that I can only officially represent one of you as my client. I can explain the procedure to the other person, and we can have sort of collaborative group discussions. But at the end of the day, I'm not going to be able to answer their legal advice questions, just like in this forum today. I can do my best to try to give information and general guidance, but I'm not looking out for their best interest, and I'm not going to be suggesting things that are to the detriment of my own client.
Well, we have callers online. By the way, you can join in, too, with your questions. The number is 1-800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org or post on our Facebook page or Ideas Network page. We'll take a call. We got Dennis and Ross and some others online waiting for us. But just a reminder, our guest today, Mike Riley, a Madison lawyer. He's been a third-generation Madison lawyer with the Axley Law Firm, as is Catherine Grigg, divorce and family lawyer, also a partner with Axley Law Firm of Madison. Our guests here on the Ideas Network. Thanks for joining us today as we visit with Michael Riley. Mike, who deals primarily in compensation for people who suffer injuries due to others' neglect. He also represents clients in insurance coverage issues, mediation, and arbitration. Catherine Grigg is divorce and family law attorney. So wonderful having them both with us. And let's go to the phones now. Dennis in Clintonville up first. Dennis, thank you for calling. What's on your mind?
Hi. We have a daughter who lives out of state. We have not had any contact with her for over a year, or the grandchildren, and we're starting to wonder if we should do something to be able to see our grandchildren, but with her being out of state, do we need a lawyer in that state, or can we handle it with a lawyer in Wisconsin?
Catherine?
Yeah, hi, Dennis. That's a great question. Typically, the place where the child resides is going to be the place that's going to have jurisdiction over this issue, and that would be the court that would get involved if you did end up needing to get some sort of legal action going. So it would be that other state. I would suggest that you speak with an attorney who is licensed to practice in that state. But I can tell you in Wisconsin, grandparents' rights and grandparent visitation is really tricky. It makes a difference in Wisconsin, if Wisconsin was going to be the one handling your case, whether or not the child's parents are or ever were married, and a different process and different legal standards apply depending on whether or not that's the case. And in situations where the grandchild, where his or her parents are still married and there's an intact family, it is very, very difficult for grandparents to get legal access to that child if the parents are choosing not to. Where would he
go to, let's say, this other state? How would he find, or how would the grandparents find, an appropriate attorney?
Well, first, you'd probably want to figure out what county your child and grandchild are residing in. And each county has a courthouse there. And one thing you might want to do is consider finding an attorney who is relatively near to that courthouse. Not that attorneys who work farther away in the county are any less qualified, but at least from a transportation travel cost standpoint, attorneys who tend to locate their offices close to courthouses tend to have a lot of regular attendance at that courthouse. What Mike described earlier, there are some websites that you can go to generally to look up lawyer reviews. Some of them are peer review websites. Some of them are websites where third parties are coming in and ranking attorneys. You have to be careful, though, because there are also websites out there where attorneys can pay to get their rating higher. And so I would take any sort of website like that, any sort of ranking website, with sort of a grain of salt. And just as Mike said, the best thing you can do is to call around and either have phone contact with that attorney. I know you might not be able to visit them in person, but check out maybe just Google websites. And at first step is to look at that attorney's own website. And then second step is to call the attorney on the phone and see if it's someone that is easy to understand, answering your questions.
Makes sense.
Yeah.
And in a phone call, that attorney might be able to give the advice that you just gave in terms of what it's like in that other state regarding grandparental rights. So
that's right. Attorneys, when we speak on the phone with potential clients, we are evaluating whether or not they even have a case to bring. And if they don't, we will certainly let them know if this type of situation is one where Dennis is not going to qualify for whatever reason. The attorney is not going to just
say, "Oh yeah,"
pretend as though he's got some case and take his money. Hopefully,
I'm going to say, Katie's being very sanguine. I think what you said. I think you're absolutely right. Most attorneys won't, but I think it's another good reason to talk to more than one attorney. I mean, if you have someone like Katie who's saying, "Look, we can do this, but it's going to be very difficult, and at the end of the day, I just can't promise you that we're going to achieve much." And you've got somebody else saying, "Yep, just send me the retainer for $5,000, and you know, I'll get this taken care of." And you know, maybe that requires a tiebreaker if you're getting very different advice. But I do think it's worthwhile to speak with more than one lawyer.
Good luck to you, Dennis. Thanks very much for calling. Appreciate your call. We'll turn to Ross in Madison next. Ross, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi. Good morning. Got a separation/divorce question. So, if the couple is, you know, if they're possibly are thinking about getting separated/divorced, and one decides to leave the home to sort of diffuse the heat or something to that effect, is that considered abandoning the home, and does that become an issue later on once the more official legal process goes on?
Hi, Ross. The short answer is no. By leaving and physically removing yourself from the house, you're not changing or minimizing what your legal rights are to that house. And in many situations, it is advisable for one spouse to get out for the exact reasons that you said, just to diffuse the situation and let tensions calm. I would say, though, that one example where it might come into play down the road is if you have minor children and the children are going to continue residing at the house and the parent who is leaving the house temporarily is not exercising their placement time with the children at their new residence. One of the factors that the court will take into consideration in a divorce, in a custody or placement dispute, is the history of caregiving that each parent has made with the kids. And so if someone moves out and for a period of time is not as actively involved in those children's daily lives anymore, that might be relevant. It really depends on the circumstances. But no, the physical act of leaving the house does not automatically mean that you won't get that house in the divorce or that the equity in the house isn't still something that needs to be divided.
No, there we go. Thank you for calling. Appreciate your call. Janelle emailed to ask how one goes about finding a missing parent regarding an interstate case. Father in New York, child in Wisconsin. There's been no contact for over a year. How does one find help filing a motion in an interstate case? If it's a New York thing, does this go back to similar to an earlier caller?
Yeah, that's right. Whenever you have more than one state involved, it's a question of jurisdiction, meaning which state is going to be the one to address this legal issue. And there are some very complicated laws that talk about how to compare between two different states if you have parents that live in two different states. And in general, the state where the child is residing and has resided for the last 6 months is going to be the state that where the legal action needs to occur. So if this question is, how do you find a parent who's living in another state so that you can serve them with some sort of motion or legal action, there's a lot of things that we do. You can hire a private investigator. I mean, those people are still around, and mm-hmm. Mike has probably had some experience with them, maybe more so than I have. Ultimately, though, if you're not able to physically locate someone, but you have a really good reason to believe that they are residing there, maybe because you get tips from friends or family, or you know that they're employed there, you just can't seem to find their physical address to serve them, eventually the court system might allow you to do something where you file a legal notice in the newspaper in the legal section. But to do that, you have to get the court's permission first, and you have to prove that you've already taken reasonable actions to try to locate that person. Mike, do you have anything that you do?
I think the suggestion about a private investigator is good, although now there's so much with social media and so many, you know, with Google and a million other ways. There are a lot of ways that you can do it yourself, I think. But if you need a private investigator, they can be really helpful. That's a big part of what they do nowadays, is finding people who don't want to be found or aren't readily available. And, you know, the cost is not nominal, but it's not terrible either. And if it's important to do it, you certainly can. I think Katie's point about, you know, we do service by publication occasionally. If we have somebody involved in an accident and we can't locate that person to physically have a process server go to their door and say, here's the summons and complaint to start the lawsuit, then we can serve them by publication. You have to send something to their last known address, and you have to publish it a certain amount of times in the paper that where you last believe they were, so that there's some reasonable hope they'll see it. It's cost some money, and it's a bit cumbersome. We certainly try to do everything else we can before we do that. But if someone is deliberately avoiding service, that's one of the ways we are able to get service on them and begin a lawsuit if necessary, or bring a motion or whatever it might be.
Oh, there we go. Thanks so much. And you can join in, too. We have some open lines. Get you on pretty quickly at 1-800-642-1234. Let's go to Chris in Watertown next. Hi, Chris.
Hi. This was many years ago, and I had never, ever worked with a lawyer before. A friend of mine, I had been in a car accident, hit by a semi-truck, and seriously injured. A friend of mine had had success with a lawyer, so I went to that lawyer and said I wanted him to represent me. And so I signed a contract. But he ended up shoving me off to another lawyer in his firm. The other lawyer was, well, he should have been retired. And I have nothing against old people. I'm an old person now. but he was completely incompetent and in the end lost the case for me.
Oh.
What recourse does a person have? I went back to the lawyer I wanted and I said, I came to you for you to represent me. And he said, well, my caseload is too large.
Yeah. So, Mike Riley, let's turn to you for that.
Yeah, that's inexcusable. I mean, first of all, if you're not going to take a case personally, you need to tell the person that. I mean, a big part of my practice and our practice, and I know the way Katie practices as well, is that when people hire us, they hire us. We have paralegals who may have to help us with things. You know, we may have other people do research. But in terms of the heavy lifting, in terms of any kind of negotiation, meeting with people, you know, discussing things with the other lawyer, doing court appearances if those become necessary, that's something that we would do personally. And I think it's a great point because it's something that anybody who's going to hire a lawyer should ask is, look, I'm talking to you. I'm making my decisions based on my assumption that you're going to be representing me. If that's not the case, you need to tell me that now. To take a case and then just shut it off to someone else without, you know, your permission is just not acceptable at all in my mind. In terms of what, you know, in all honesty, and again, I'm not being critical of you in any way, shape, or form. You're in that position. You assume that, you know, they're giving you to somebody who knows what they're doing. But if somebody's in that position and now suddenly there's this effort to have somebody else handle the case, I think you need to go back to the lawyer and say, wait a minute, this isn't the agreement. I didn't say, oh, I signed an agreement. You sign it with the firm. So you signed on with the firm. The fact is, you interviewed a lawyer. You made your decision to hire that lawyer. If they're not going to work on your case, then they should release you from the contract and let you go ahead and work with someone else. In terms of what happens afterwards, and, you know, obviously I don't know the details, but if you're not properly represented, you know, ultimately the remedy you have is a legal malpractice action. I've handled those. I don't take any pleasure in doing it, but I think people have a right to be properly represented. And if they're not, and if you get an adverse result because you weren't properly represented, then you have every right, and you should contact another lawyer and say, hey, here's what happened. I just don't believe I was properly and competently represented. Is there something I can do? And let another lawyer look at it and evaluate it for you.
Yeah. And it's probably something that, and now in Chris's case that happened years ago, it's something you need to do.
It's generally a 6-year statute of limitations on malpractice. But you'd have to check. I mean, in any situation, the best thing to do is check with the lawyer. And you're right, Larry. Obviously, if it happened years ago, you know, it's probably, unfortunately, you know, water over the dam. But, it's a shame, and I'm terribly sorry that you had that experience.
And Chris, thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. We have more callers online here. Dan in Franksville, I think it's your turn next. Let's go there. Hi, Dan.
Yeah, I'm calling him for a friend of mine. Their son had a child with his wife, and she left with the child to the state of Washington and was only going to be there a week and decided not to come back. I don't know if you'd go to a prosecutor for that before you'd even go to a lawyer, but it's been a while, though. And
there's probably some things I would probably be looking at my divorce decree, for one thing, but I'm not the lawyer here.
Yeah, Dan, did you say, is the couple divorced already, or are they still married?
Oh, no, they were married, you know, they're married and everything,
Still married.
But, his mother just left, and then says I'm staying in Washington now.
Yeah.
Oh.
Does your friend at least know where in Washington she's residing?
They talk to one another.
Mm-hmm.
And happily, she just says, I decided that I'm going to stay out here and I'm not coming back to Wisconsin.
The reason I asked that question is because there's actually a criminal law that can come into play if one parent interferes with custody against the other parent. But that typically involves a situation where the remaining parent has absolutely no idea and can't communicate with the child or the other parent, and that's a situation where you get the police involved. What Dan, you're describing your friend's situation is not one where I think the police need to be involved. I think it's one where the court might need to be involved in some sort of separation case. And it doesn't have to be a divorce or even a legal separation. There are other types of cases that parents can bring to the court's attention if they want to still stay married, but they need there to be some court order in place that talks about what each of their respective rights are with respect to their kids or their finances. So the first thing your friend probably wants to figure out is whether he is now interested in getting a divorce or legal separation. And then that second question is going to be one that we've talked about before. Well, which state is going to be the best state for the jurisdiction? Should it be a divorce case that's brought in Wisconsin now, or does it need to be a case that's brought in Washington? And each state has their own laws that tell us when a couple is eligible to even file for a divorce in that particular state. There's certain residency requirements, and you have to live there for such a period of time. So if you start out in one state and then it turns out that maybe the other state is the better venue, there are ways to then switch midstream without necessarily having to start over.
So if you happen to be working with a lawyer, his friend, here in Wisconsin, mm-hmm. perhaps that lawyer would have resources or access to lawyers in the state of Washington, for example, that would...
They might, but certainly the lawyer here in Wisconsin should be bringing up these issues so that before Dan's friend hires a Wisconsin lawyer, he can also evaluate whether instead he should be hiring a Washington lawyer to do a Washington divorce.
I see.
So that's one of those things that comes up in the initial consult.
Sure. Katie, I know people probably heard kind of the race to the courthouse thing. In that situation, would one of the considerations be whether you want to go ahead and file something here since the marriage was here and the home was here before she left? And would it be important to sort of get in before maybe she jumps into court in Washington, or does it really not make much difference one way or another?
It absolutely could make a difference. If he files first here in Wisconsin, she may not know or realize that she could have filed in Washington. And mm-hmm. so she might continue following the divorce procedure here in Wisconsin without ever complaining about it or raising the issue that Washington should be considered. But different states have different laws that come into play about how assets and debts get divided, and how child support is calculated, and family support.
And visitation.
Yeah, and so no attorney is going to be able to say initially which spouse or which state will have a better result for a particular client, but there might be reasons why, under the facts of his case, he might come out better in a Washington mm-hmm. divorce court than he might in Wisconsin. And so that's why before he retains any lawyer, he wants to evaluate the differences, the pros and the cons of filing in each state.
Yeah.
And probably the one thing I would think, if he talked to a Wisconsin lawyer, I'm sure if he came to you and started asking questions, I mean, there are things. It's not like you practice there. It's just different. People can mm-hmm. say, well, we can look up the law, and you can't. A lawyer can probably at least take a look and have some idea about what the pros and cons are in general terms. One of the things you never know, and Katie said previously, if you can find somebody in a particular county, it's helpful. part of the law is the law. It's the way they do things. Part of the law is subjective, and it's which judge do you want to draw? what do you know the other lawyer? Are you able to work with them? And so there's when you're doing things like that, it isn't just a matter of whether you know the law or not. It's a lot about whether you know the custom, whether you know how the practice is in that area.
Yeah, and family law in particular is really discretionary, meaning the law sort of sets out what the factors are for a court to consider in custody and placement arrangements and even in property division or support calculations. But the ultimate decision of the court is something that takes into account not only how those factors are weighed against one another, but also any other factors that the court finds relevant. And so I could look up what the laws are for a particular state pretty easily, but as Mike said, knowing how that particular court is likely to rule and what sorts of factors they prioritize over others is not something that an out-of-state attorney is necessarily going to know.
Yeah. Lots of things to consider there, Dan. Thanks a lot for calling, and good luck to you and to your friend. Appreciate the call. Mona in Madison will give you a chance next. Mona, hi. Thanks for calling.
Hi, thank you. I have a question. I have a living revocable trust that I set up in 18 years ago, and it costs $600 to have it done. And I'd like to update some of the beneficiaries, and that's all. And I called the firm that set it up for me, and they told me it's going to be $3,000 just to change the few beneficiaries around, and about saying it. And I'm wondering if that's normal, and also if how much, if I could do it by myself or if I would just make a big mess out of it.
Yeah.
Yeah, we're both looking at one another and seeing which of us that doesn't do that work should answer your question. You know, yeah, Katie's probably much closer. I'll give you my shot, and then Katie can certainly chime in. I'm sorry, okay. It's Catherine officially, but I think of her as Katie. So anyway, first of all, I mean, honestly, that seems an extraordinary amount of money for what you're describing if all you're doing is changing beneficiaries. I don't do that work, so, for me to say it, but I had a trust drafted by one of our lawyers for, just transferring some property to my kids. And it was the same kind of thing, was a revocable trust. And drafting it initially was about a third of that. So that does seem like a significant amount of money, unless I'm just not understanding what's going on. So, Katie?
No, yeah, I agree with that. If it's just changing the beneficiary designations, you might want to call around to a few other law firms in town and get other price quotes from them.
Right.
But the fact...
But on a CD, I mean, how hard is it?
Yeah.
But the fact that your trust was drafted, I think you said 18 years ago, is that right?
Yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah.
That's... The laws have changed since then, including, tax laws are much different now, and a lot of the other considerations that you factor in when you're coming up with an estate plan. And that reason alone might be a reason why you want to have maybe a broader conversation with an estate planning lawyer, not just changing beneficiary designations, but that might be why the lawyer you contacted is saying, look, I anticipate this is going to morph into something bigger than just changing beneficiary designations. If you have no interest in doing that whatsoever and you just want to let sleeping dogs lie, call around to some other places and get other quotes.
I wouldn't do it yourself because Katie's point's well taken that laws change. There may be reasons why there may be other things change. But that said, I still can't imagine. I mean, I would think it'd be a half an hour conversation and probably at most, and I think any good lawyer knows that the laws have changed. It shouldn't take that long to read through it. I think if you talk to some different firms and, get some quotes. But I would talk to a lawyer about it just to ensure that any changes that have happened wouldn't make what you have now inappropriate in some way.
There you go. Good luck, Mona. Thank you for calling. Visiting today about all kinds of legal issues, divorce and others, with our two guests, Mike Riley, Madison attorney with the Axley Law Firm, as is Catherine Grigg, divorce. She's in divorce and family law and also a partner in the Axley Law Firm. I'm Larry Mueller. Jill Nadeau, our producer, here on the Ideas Network. Taking a look at legal issues today with Michael Riley and Catherine Grigg from the Axley Law Firm in Madison. And lots of callers online. I think we'll go to Jennifer in Appleton next for a call. Jennifer, hi. Thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
Hi. Thanks for the program. I am a fellow attorney in Appleton, Wisconsin, and I have a couple of suggestions for the caller who was hit by a semi-truck and felt she did not receive appropriate representation.
Yeah.
Okay. The first resource she could contact is the State Bar of Wisconsin. The State Bar of Wisconsin has a Wisconsin's Lawyers Fund for Client Protection, and clients who have been harmed by their attorneys can potentially try to regain some of their monetary damages from this fund. Mm-hmm. And I can give you the 1-800 number if you'd like that.
Sure.
800-444-9404, extension 6623. And that is the State Bar of Wisconsin's Fund for Client Protection.
Mm-hmm. So it's that 1-800-444-9404, extension 6623.
That's correct. Now, the second option this lady has is through the Office of Lawyer Regulation, who are based in Madison. And the Office of Lawyer Regulation hears complaints about attorneys dealing with ethical violations of the ethical professional rules of responsibility that we're supposed to follow. And she, this woman could give them a call to get some forms and see if she is able to file an ethical complaint against this attorney. And I can give you a phone number for that also.
Okay.
877-315-6941. This, mm-hmm. This office is part of the Wisconsin Supreme Court oversight, and this Office of Lawyer Regulation is charged with investigating grievances against attorneys who are licensed to practice in Wisconsin.
Oh, Jennifer, thanks so much for calling. Mike Riley, a comment.
No, I think those are both good suggestions. I think people have to be aware of a couple things. One, there are limitations on what you can do through the State Bar, what they will pay back. Some of it has to do with trust funds. There are other things. It's broader than that, but it isn't quite the same thing as being able to pursue a malpractice claim and fully recovering what you've lost as a result of the lawyer's failure to exercise due care. But I think it's certainly something that's worth exploring, and it's a good suggestion. OLR particularly, does not really produce a financial remedy for what you've suffered. What it will do is result in discipline for the lawyer. And the caller earlier had made the point that she didn't want this to happen to someone else, which is great, and it shouldn't. And I think that if a lawyer does engage in conduct that's inappropriate, it is absolutely the case that they should face discipline that can include up to and including the loss of their license to practice. And there are a number of other levels of discipline. Nobody wants that, I can tell you. Lawyers, nobody wants to receive a complaint. OLR, I think, takes these very seriously, does a good job of investigating. They have committees of other lawyers to look at it. So I think that if you have something where you feel a lawyer has not behaved appropriately, get the information from OLR and by all means file a complaint.
Yeah. Thank you again, Jennifer, for calling. Appreciate it. Larry emailed with a personal injury situation. If someone gets injured in a store and can't work, the person has incurred medical bills and has missed work, is it time to hire an attorney, and how are attorneys compensated in these cases? And here we don't know if Larry was injured in the store he was working at or if he was a potential customer in that store.
Right. And that's right, Larry. That's a critical distinction. If you're injured at your place of employment, then your remedy is workers' compensation. And workers' comp will take care of the medical bills that you incur as a result of the injuries. You'll be paid a percentage of your salary if you miss work. And so it's a good system if you're at work and just one of those things, people get hurt lifting or things that it's nobody's
sure.
fault. It's not such a great system if you're injured through somebody else's fault who's a co-employee or because your employer did something wrong, because it's an exclusive remedy. You can't sue those people under Wisconsin law. Now, if you're just a frequenter, you're somebody there shopping and you're injured because, you know, the store or one of its employees did something negligent to create a hazardous condition and you're injured as a result. You know, the example, if somebody spills water on the floor and they don't clean it up promptly enough, if there's something that there's a defect in one of the shelves and those things collapse and you end up being injured as a result of that, then, you know, you certainly can pursue an action for your injuries, for the loss of income, for your medical bills. And that's a great case where, yep, you should go and talk to a lawyer. Those cases particularly, and slip and falls are very common sources of injury in stores. Those are not the easiest cases, and you have to basically have the person, the employer, the store, has to have had notice of the condition, either actual or constructive, which usually means enough time went by so they should have known, even if they didn't. And then they have to have had an opportunity to correct the problem. And if they had both those things and didn't do it, then you have a real chance of recovery. But the best thing to do is call lawyers, talk to a lawyer, explain the situation, and then they can evaluate it. In terms of compensation, lawyers in personal injury matters are almost always paid on a contingent or percentage fee basis. They recover a percent. They recover a percentage of what they get for you. They also incur costs, and those come out of the settlement. Beyond that, you should not be getting a bill for any time spent or anything else. But that's also something, if you are going to hire a lawyer in personal injury, make sure you understand exactly how they are going to be compensated, what percentage, you know, how that's going to work, what's included in that. Those are all things you should make sure you get clear before you put your, I guess it's not a dotted line, in our case it's a solid line, but before you sign up, make sure you know what you're signing up for.
Makes good sense. Well, Christine in Milwaukee has a question. Let's go there. Hi, Christine.
Hi. I have a question about a divorce with arbitration and things like the arbitrator overturned what the court ordered my ex-husband to pay. There was an equalization payment of over $200,000. I mean, and that was put on just before court. And is there a recourse when you go through arbitration? I was ill and having a difficult time with surgeries and whatnot, and
so
that I spoke to my lawyer about was never even mentioned in arbitration on my behalf. Not a single thing.
Yeah. Christine, I'm sorry to hear about that difficult situation. Arbitration is an alternative to using a judge to decide your case. Arbitration is where the two parties usually hire someone else. Sometimes it's a retired judge. Sometimes it's another attorney or whoever to come in and to listen to their positions and then to make a decision. And that decision is binding and is usually incorporated into some sort of court order that courts will enforce as well. In general, it is very difficult to appeal an arbitrator's decision. Very, very difficult. There are some certain situations, but arbitration, like I said, is where you're basically using someone else as the decision maker. And so one of the risks going into arbitration is that you are potentially losing this right to appeal that you otherwise might have if you used a judge to make your decision.
But if she's not happy with the attorney and the attorney's handling of it, going back to probably what we talked about earlier, Catherine.
Yeah, I think it's the same suggestions earlier, that if it was the attorney who you felt was not providing you with competent or diligent representation, you can pursue either an ethical disciplinary complaint against the attorney or potentially speak with another lawyer to see if you have a potential claim for legal malpractice.
Yeah. Christine, the one thing that struck me is you said that the arbitrator overturned what the judge had done. And you know, as Katie said, normally, you know, you have one or the other, but not both. So was this kind of post-divorce?
It was post.
Okay.
It was the first time we went to court, and it was a commissioner of court.
Right.
Yeah.
A court commissioner?
And then the attorney that did the arbitration just said he owes you nothing you know, him nothing. What you have, what he has, he has.
Okay, so courts in Wisconsin have judges, but then they also utilize court commissioners who are court officials that in family law cases handle a number of issues leading up to trial. And it's usually the court commissioner that you're in front of who will make the initial decisions concerning custody and placement and financial decisions about how things will work while the divorce is pending. And those are done through temporary orders. They can also, court commissioners also come into play after a divorce is finalized if someone files a motion to modify one of the terms of a divorce that can be modified. Sometimes court commissioners do make those decisions. If it was a court commissioner who made the decision, there is something called a de novo appeal that you can utilize within a certain period of time, and it's varies from county to county, but it's usually somewhere in the 10 to 15 days of when the court commissioner makes their decision, you have the opportunity to appeal that court commissioner's decision to the judge. And if you don't file your de novo appeal request within that period of time, sometimes you forfeit that right. So if it was truly a court commissioner, then that decision can be reviewed by a judge, and it's a totally different standard. But if it was someone outside of the court system that was hired specifically to be the arbitrator, it goes back to what I said earlier. Those are very difficult to appeal.
And if it's already gone by 15 days, perhaps it's a moot point?
If the county, in this, I think you said Milwaukee County, if the de novo period has lapsed, then you no longer have the opportunity to appeal that particular decision. Whether or not you have the right to bring a new motion altogether based on some new circumstance or a new legal threshold, that could still apply.
Good luck, Christine. Thank you. Michael Riley and Catherine Grigg from the Axley Law Firm in Madison, our guests. They'll be with us till 12:30. We'll take a quick look at the news and weather, and then we'll be back. Stay with us. Talking about legal issues on the program today, I'm Larry Mueller. Great to have you along today. Mike Riley is back with us, represents clients in insurance coverage issues, mediation and arbitration, a senior partner in the Axley Law Firm in Madison. And with Mike, Catherine Grigg is a divorce and family law attorney, also a partner in the Axley Law Firm. Legal questions, give a call at 1-800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org or post on our Facebook page, on the Ideas Network page. And just a reminder, our talk today is intended as general information. You shouldn't rely on it or construe it as legal advice as well. So we put that little disclaimer in there, and with that, we'll take some calls because all our lines are filled. And Rusty and Rudolph, I think it's your turn. Rusty, hi. Thanks for calling.
Thank you. Say, just a quick question. I'm curious, is it legal, or do I, can I say an individual take a municipality such as a village or a township like that to court over a money issue? It's not a lot of money, but it's money all the same, and rather than hire a private attorney, can the court system, the small claims court system, be used that way?
You know, simple answer is I think so. That's the only honest answer, because I just haven't had that specific situation. But generally speaking, you know, small claims court is intended to be simple, less expensive, not require an attorney. And usually it has the same jurisdiction. The limits are financial. You have to look at what you can do. I think they've raised them now, so I think it may be up to $10,000. It has been $5,000 traditionally. Has to be within that amount for you to bring it. So if you have something that doesn't involve as much money, you can use small claims court. Again, if it's something you could do in circuit court, you probably can do it in small claims court. I'm not aware of anything that excludes doing that with a municipality, but I, in all honesty, haven't looked at it, so I can't rule it out. Simple thing to do is go to the courthouse, go to the small claims people. They're generally good about, they've got forms you can use. They'll explain the process, and my guess is that they would be able to tell you real quickly whether for any reason you can't do that with a municipality. But in general, my guess would be you could.
There you go. Thanks for calling. Let's turn to Cheryl in Conover next. Hi, Cheryl.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Yeah, what's on your mind?
You were just talking about going through a divorce state by state. Well, I can tell you in the state of Wisconsin, having gone through a divorce, it even makes a difference in county by county. Because as an example, in Ozaukee County, if you want to have a divorce, you used to have to go to counseling for 6 weeks. But in Vilas County up north, you don't have to do that. You can just go through a divorce. So people who are going through those troubling times, if they feel that they don't really want to go through another 6 weeks of counseling because they've just been through 6 weeks of counseling, they might want to check on their county.
Yeah, that's a great point, Cheryl. Also, even within a county, the divorce process can be different from case to case because the court officials, the judge and the court commissioner, they have a tremendous amount of discretion over what the two parties in a divorce need to accomplish in order to get the divorce done. And so it is within the court's authority to order counseling of those parties in certain situations. And so even in Vilas County, it is possible that the judge could order parties to attend counseling as a condition of satisfying a court order, even though that's not required of all people in that particular county.
Yeah, go ahead, Mike.
Well, some of it sounds a little bit like she's talking about forum shopping, and I don't mean that in any negative way. But some counties, plaintiffs like some counties much better than others, so we may file a case somewhere. There are rules, though, that govern where you can begin a case, and I don't know if that would apply here. I mean, if the marriage, if you're both living in, you know, Ozaukee County, could you file a divorce in Vilas?
No, you can't. There are residential requirements that in order to file for divorce, at least one spouse has to have resided in that particular county for at least 30 days. So if the two spouses are already living in different counties, then they sort of have a choice between those two counties. But otherwise, you're limited to the county that you're both living in.
And there's one thing that struck me. I was thinking back to a friend who was getting divorced, and the spouse was angry because there's a state law that you can't get remarried for at least 6 months.
Yes.
And that person said the ex-spouse came back to him 6 months later and said, boy, I'm glad they had that 6 month waiting period, because they didn't get married. They found out that it was probably a good idea. Yeah. They didn't get married.
Yeah. Out of the frying pan into the fire.
Well, and Wisconsin is in a minority of states that have a waiting period. Most states do not have a waiting period before you can get remarried. And Wisconsin's is the longest in the country as well, 6 months. So there are a few other states out there that do have the waiting period, but it's much shorter, like 30 days. And the reason for the waiting period, one of the reasons is because the law wants to allow people who might have buyer's remorse to have their divorce vacated within a certain period of time without much consequence to them. So the laws do say that if within the first 6 months after a divorce, the now ex-spouses change their mind and decide that they want to be married again, it's a pretty simple procedure to vacate your divorce judgment and resume your status as a married couple.
Yeah, and it worked out pretty well in that other instance as well for the one spouse. Jacob in Madison, your turn. Hi, Jacob.
Hi. I'm calling because I'm a little flustered. I was told last week at my workplace by my employer that she was concerned about me because I'm getting so old, and that she was cutting my salary in half. And I asked what part of my work she wanted me to stop doing, and she said, well, I still want you to do your job. And so I'm a little bit frustrated. I was also told that I wouldn't have a problem because I'm so talented and skilled at what I do. I went to the job fair in Dean County last Wednesday and tried to follow up on the couple of leads I had, but haven't gotten any responses to the voicemails that I left. So I'm also facing my 66th birthday in September.
Mm-hmm.
And so this coming month, in April, my pay will be reduced down to 75% of what I usually earn. And then the following months, May, June, July, and August, I'll be getting 50% of what I was earning. And then she said we'd talk again in September. But I think I can read the writing on the wall.
Oh, well,
I mean, that seems to me to be blatant age discrimination. There's been no other justification offered. You need to talk to a lawyer who does that work. It isn't my field. But my understanding is I believe 70 is the cutoff age, and at that point, but within that, you know, you can't discriminate based on age. Now, again, there are all sorts of caveats to the rules, but that just seems to be so extreme that I can't imagine that that doesn't present a problem. And what I do is, you know, look for people who handle employment issues, because that's what that is generally. If you can find somebody, fine. If you can't find somebody, call our firm and I'll give you a recommendation, because you should certainly explore that. That just doesn't seem right. Again, I have very limited knowledge of the area, but the knowledge I do have would suggest to me that that's a violation and that cannot be permitted.
Good luck, Jacob. Thank you so much for calling. Mike Riley and Catherine Gregg, our guests today with the Axley Law Firm in Madison. Jessica in Eau Claire, we'll go to you next. Hi, Jessica.
Hi. The topic of grandparents' rights was brought up earlier in case if the parents are still together. I was wondering, is it more difficult if the parents were never married and they still are not together? Is it hard for a grandparent to get rights to see a child, a grandchild?
Well, it's always difficult for someone who is not a parent to come in and get visitation rights of a child, especially if it's taking time away from a parent who is there. Between a situation where you have parents who are married and aren't married, the laws are set up a little bit more favorably to get visitation rights if the parents were never married and you don't have this intact family situation that I described earlier. But even in that situation where the child's parents aren't married, or maybe one parent is deceased, grandparents cannot come in and automatically assert rights and get visitation. There's going to be an analysis done through the court system to determine what's in that child's best interest and whether or not the decision of the parent or parents who are choosing to exclude that grandparent, whether those decisions should continue to apply, because there's a constitutional protection that parents have to make choices over their children's care. And so it's only in very specific and limited situations where anyone, including grandparents, are going to be able to come in and get visitation. The most common situation, and what the law is really geared towards, is a situation where you have a grandparent who had an active involvement in that child's life, and then all of a sudden that grandparent's child, one of the parents, either dies or is somehow then not in the picture, and the remaining parent is now excluding that grandparent who the child is very bonded to. That's what the law describes as being the most favorable situation for a grandparent to come in and get visitation rights.
Thank you very much for calling.
Larry, before we take that, let me just make a couple quick comments, not on that.
Okay.
Excellent job. One, in terms of finding a lawyer, the State Bar has a lawyer referral and information service. So the gentleman who called about age discrimination, they will be able to find you a lawyer or direct you to a lawyer or lawyers in this area that would handle you know, employment issues from an employee standpoint. And that's one resource. You know, you may be, there may be others. You can go online and certainly put in age discrimination law or some things like that. But that's something people should keep in mind.
So where is it again?
It's Lawyer Referral and Information Service.
Okay.
It's with the State Bar of Wisconsin. So
gotcha.
If you call the State Bar or go online, they'll have a subheading for that, or you can call them and they'll direct you to that. Second thing, just real quickly on arbitration. You know, Katie did a great job at describing the downsides of arbitration. There are upsides. There are positives. Tends to be less expensive, less drawn out. I mean, that's one of the reasons that people opt for it. But I think that that's something you need to talk to your lawyer about very carefully before you make a decision, because arbitration is done with often with three-person panels, sometimes a single person. I prefer three-person panels because you get a balance, and
yeah.
which you sometimes don't with a single person. And as Katie said, the biggest downside is that it's almost impossible to appeal those. There are very limited grounds. You have a much better chance of having a judge's ruling overturned than you do of having anybody do anything with an arbitrator's ruling. So before you go that route, you need to understand that what you're committing yourself to and what the downside is, which is it tends to be very much set in stone.
Catherine, we had an email from Bree to say her uncle is trying to divorce someone who he can't find. He was told at the first hearing that because of that, he had to publish the court notice in the newspaper. Is he supposed to publish the initial hearing date or the final date, or what is he supposed to do?
That's interesting. We've had so many missing persons calls
today. Yeah.
To initiate a divorce case, the very first paperwork that gets filed with the court is called the summons and the petition. And that, if that document, if those documents have not yet been served on this person, that's what needs to get published in the court newspaper in order for the divorce court to even proceed with your case. You have to prove that you have been able to serve the other side.
Have not been able to.
Even after you do the publication, the court wants to know that the other party has been afforded the opportunity to get notice of this lawsuit.
Gotcha.
So the initial hearing date, if that was scheduled at the same time that the summons and petition was filed, then all of those things are what needs to get rolled into that court notice.
Normally, once you do that, if they don't respond to that, if they just default, then normally you probably don't have to provide them, you know, you don't have to publish everything from then on going forward, I don't believe. But that's, you know, certainly the first publication is critical.
John in Washburn, your turn. Hi, John.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I'm 62. I'm on disability and on Medicaid. I'm on my great-grandfather's Pioneer Farm. Since I'm an only child, I ended up being the one that ended up getting all of the property and the personal possessions on the farm. It's been in the family for over 100 years. I'd like to know what my best option would be, whether I should just change the property over to some cousins' names and retain a life estate in the property, or should I try to set up a trust since there are multiple individuals involved and maintain a life estate, or is there another direction?
Yep, I can feel this to some extent. Just transferring title over to your cousin, you need to be careful because there might be some gift tax implications that come into play if you're not planning to actually sell it to them. So I would caution you against doing that without first speaking with a lawyer to figure out whether that's even a tax-free option to you. In general, you want to be speaking with a lawyer to figure out whether or not you need some sort of comprehensive living trust, and that might be advisable depending on the size of the estate. The farm itself is a piece of real estate, and there are tools like transfer on death deeds and other sorts of documents that you can file with the local register of deeds office that have the effect of transferring title to real estate after you die. But it's much more than that. Those types of deeds don't cover all of the personal property that you have or your other assets. And so that type of device, that document, is really just one piece of a greater puzzle of your estate plan. So you you know, we're not in a position today to know what all of the different pieces of this puzzle are and what your total financial situation is. So that's the best suggestion I can give to you, is to speak with someone who is going to have
which
all of that
information. Which attorney would have...
An estate planning attorney. The fact that he, that John, that you are on disability and receiving Medicaid, those are also very important factors that an estate planning attorney is going to take into consideration, because, you know, you have certain benefits there and maybe some survivor's benefits that that could come into play as well. And estate planning attorneys are... The good ones are well-versed in not just estate planning and wills and trusts, but also tax issues and other sorts of benefits.
Yeah.
And, you know, being 62, there are Social Security implications that come into play soon if they haven't already. A good estate planning attorney is going to look at all of the different factors and come up with a plan to maximize the benefits for your desired beneficiaries and how best to accomplish that without paying more taxes than what's necessary.
There we go. Thank you so much. Good luck, John. Appreciate your call. And we had an email from Gail to say her father's will says that she gets 25% of the assets of, you know, her father. The executor thinks she deserves 100%. What recourse does Gail have?
Does that mean Gail would not get the 100% and the executor's getting 100%? If the executor's telling Gail, you actually get 100%, not 25, I think Gail should just shut her mouth and take the check.
Or it may be a situation where the father has donated 75% to his church or something like that.
It sounds to me like the executor's saying that they get 100%, because otherwise I don't know why Gail would be concerned. You know, I mean, there's certainly things you can do. I mean, if there's a will, the will lays it out. You put the will in probate, and, you know, no matter what the executor says, the executor doesn't get to call the shots. The executor is executing the will of the person, you know, the will of the person who made the will, who's leaving the estate. So certainly if what the executor is saying is inconsistent with the estate, and as a result of that, Gail's not getting what she should, you know, she can take the, you know, insist that the executor file that for probate and follow the wishes of the decedent.
No.
Probate means there's a probate court that the will gets filed in, and it becomes a legal proceeding where a judge gets involved and makes a decision.
What about a situation, we're starting to run a little bit out of time, so I'm going to paraphrase one here, where a person bit into a burrito and there was a thumbtack in it.
Those are certainly, it's a legitimate claim. It's generally pretty much strict liability because food is not supposed to have that in it. And so there's no, you can't say, oh, gee, that just happens. Question's always, how much are you talking about? What kind of damages did you suffer? I'd go back to where we started and say, if this is not a matter of suffering some kind of really significant injury, you know, I'd call wherever you had the burrito. Presumably you reported it at the time. I'd talk to them. I'd get them to pay the medical bills and pay you a reasonable amount of money for having gone through a miserable experience. I try to do that on your own before I'd involve a lawyer.
Yeah, that makes good sense to me. So I guess the divorce rate for baby boomers is about doubled.
It's certainly on the rise, yes.
And right. And tripled, so there's probably no shortage of business for any attorney that's in your shoes.
Yeah, and baby boomers face some very specific issues as well, dealing with retirement benefits and retirement planning and how that's going to factor into the divorce. So those are situations where a lawyer might be even more essential.
Well, I tell you what, this has been an interesting 90 minutes. I want to thank you both for taking time to be with us today. It's been a great pleasure. I hope we can do it again.
Thanks, Larry. It's always a pleasure.
Thank you so much. Our guests today, Michael Riley and Catherine Grigg. They are, Mike is a senior partner in the Axley Law Firm of Madison. Catherine, a partner as well in the Axley Law Firm. I learned a lot. I bet you did as well. And hopefully we'll have a chance to talk again about this tomorrow. Hey, it's Friday. That means Garden Talk, and we'll be taking a look at ways to garden on a budget and how to put together a great window box, among other things. In the meantime, stay with us. Lots in store.